Welcome to Creative Maine, an hour-long monthly program produced for and broadcast by WERU 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine, and at weru.org. This show considers the making of craft, fine art, food, literature, music, dance, museums, and any other form of creative expression here in Maine. We also discuss topics of global cultural significance and interest. My name is Adina Salmonson, and please forgive me for sounding very croaky on this episode. I am your host for this monthly exploration of all things creative. Should you have comments, questions, input, or suggestions for the show, send them to info@weru.org. Please list Creative Maine in the subject line. As a lifelong musician and crafter, I am thrilled to be presenting my areas of interest and passion to you on our wonderful community radio station right here in my Orland backyard. On today's episode, we meet four exquisitely trained, world-class musical instrument makers and restorers who live and work here in Maine. We will peer through a magical window of instrument making with Nate Slobodkin of Slobodkin Violins in Bangor, Leslie Ross of Leslie Ross Bassoons in Penobscot, and David and Nick Wallace of Wallace Pipe Organs in Gorham. Welcome, Nathan Slobodkin, to Creative Maine. I'm so glad you could come on the program with me and talk about yourself and a subject that is rather near and dear to my heart. So you are a violin maker in Bangor, also known as a luthier. And can you explain to us who and what you are exactly?
Well, there is a difference between violin maker and luthier. Luthier is an older term, which used to mean a lute maker, and then encompassed all stringed instruments. But today, most people either do fretted instruments or they do violin family instruments, which would be violin, viola, cello, and the classical strings. And they're really two different professions at this point. So that's why I say I am a violin maker. And violin maker includes the making of instruments, the restoration and repair of instruments, adjusting instruments for players, and to some degree, expertise in history and identification of instruments.
And are you an appraiser as well, Nate?
I do appraisals. That's a small part of my business. And there are people who are, that becomes a large part of the business, who are real experts. There's not very many of them. I would say there's about 100 on the earth who I would say are really experts. And in fact, a well-respected colleague of mine told me once that really being able to recognize the work of one maker with absolutely no doubt in your mind is already an accomplishment. And of course, there are thousands and thousands of makers over time. Right. So expertise is a separate specialty. I was a maker. And my training started when I was 16 as an intern in the Smithsonian Institution, violin, rather musical instrument restoration shop. They did not do all that many violin stuff, but they had some. But that collection has everything from Steiner violins to church organs. And the people in charge were actually keyboard specialists. But I was there for 10 months and I learned a lot. And then was advised to get as much woodworking training as I could in any type of woodworking. And I spent the next 10 years working in music stores, doing repairs and restoration, making some instruments. About 10 years later, I met Boyd Polson, who was the secretary of the American Federation of Violin and Bowmakers. And I asked him what was required to join that professional organization. And at that time, it was 3 years of training as a violin maker, 3 years of training as a restorer, 3 years of running your own shop, and then you could apply. And the application meant that you presented your credentials, you presented an instrument for examination by the Board of Governors, and if the board okayed your credentials and your instrument, then the membership could vote on you whether they wanted you as a member of the Federation. Well, at that point, I realized I had to just back up and start over, that everything I had been doing for the past 10 years was not really the way I should have been trained. So I applied for schools and I was accepted, but I also at that time met William Harris Lee, who was starting a shop in Chicago. He was actually a wholesaler of wood and tools and strings and that sort of thing. But he had started a shop where he had three makers making instruments for him. And he suggested I come out there and apprentice. So that's what I did. And I was an apprentice to William Wedby, who was the head of the shop. Mm-hmm. And I was with him for 5 years. And then after that, I went to Jacques Francais Rare Violins in New York, which was the premier seller of Stradivari and Guarnieri instruments in the world at the time. And I went there for 2 years and then came back to Bangor to set up my shop again, which I had closed to go to Chicago. And I've been here ever since. And I was primarily a maker, a wholesale manufacturer. I was the house brand for Rooning & Son in Boston for many years, and then eventually Carriage House. So that was my largest dealer. And I've always had a retail shop here in Bangor as well, and taking care of local musicians and people who are traveling through and, you know, doing repairs and restoration and sales, and just a local violin shop as well.
Wow. So are you a Maine guy originally?
I'm actually from Michigan, but I have lived here most of my life. And wow. The longest time I was away was when I was doing my apprenticeship.
Okay, so I would like to back up just 1 second. I understand everything you're talking about, but our listeners may not, if they're not familiar. When you talk about Stradivari and Guarnieri, these are famous names in violin making that date back to the 17th century or
18th century primarily, but some into the 17th.
Right. And so there, most people know about a Stradivarius, and, you know, and there was a time in this country where, and in Germany, I guess, where everybody put a sticker inside a violin and said Stradivarius. And, but that meant it was in the style of, you know.
Right. Exactly.
And I remember people coming to our shop one long ago in New York and saying, well, he could have visited Czechoslovakia, couldn't he? It's like, no. Anyway, so people may be surprised that a craft associated with 17th and 18th century Italians, like Stradivarius, is practiced in 21st century Maine. And so I guess I have a question about violin making in the United States as a tradition, and most specifically in New England. What can you tell us about that?
Well, there were violin makers early on coming from England. So there are several instrument makers that we know about who were here in the late 18th century, the Revolutionary War times, or slightly before. But there was not a lot of violin making as a profession in the United States for quite a long time. And there were amateur makers. I would say in the mid-19th century, there was some pretty good violin making going on, mostly by immigrants. There were immigrants coming from Germany to Philadelphia, and there were several very good shops down there, whole families that were making instruments there. There were makers coming to New York. There were makers coming to Boston. And so there's actually schools of violin making, and by school, I mean in the same sense as a school of painting or something, that you can recognize Boston-made instruments. You can recognize Philadelphia-made instruments. New York, less so, because most of those people were immigrants and they were coming from all over. and they followed the tradition they had learned in Europe. But so by the mid-19th century, there was some violin making going on. And then there was, in Maine, a lot of amateur violin making right around the turn of the 20th century. There was actually a Portland, Maine violin making club or society. And some of them were very good. But it was mostly amateurs. They were working, you know, a lot of them were, I think, pattern makers or cabinet makers and other kinds of woodworkers who decided to make some instruments. But there were no real schools, as in training schools, in the United States until the 1970s. A German named Peter Preer came to the United States and started a violin making school. And now there are still several good violin making schools, including in Boston. The North Bennett Street School is very good.
So Peter Preer's school was in Salt Lake City, right?
Preer was in Salt Lake City, and that school, I believe, is still going, but Peter is gone. He has passed away, and I would not say that his school is as good as it once was. I think that the North Bennett Street and Chicago schools have kind of taken their place. But since those schools started, there are many, many violin makers working in the United States, and some place, obviously, more than others. Maine is... there's not too many of us here, but Boston is, you can't throw a stone without hitting one. And I think New York, the same, Philadelphia, and the West Coast, Los Angeles, San Francisco, there are a lot of violin makers working in the United States now.
And Chicago, because of the school, people tend to settle around where they were trained.
Yeah, I would agree. So yeah, there's a lot of instrument making going on in the United States now, and it's as good, at least as good, as most of what is happening in Europe. One of the premier shops in the world was Charles Baer had a shop in London, which was considered one of the most prestigious. And his son came to the violin making school in Salt Lake City. He did not go to Germany. He did not go to Switzerland. He came to the United States to go to school. So that tells you something about that.
Yeah, so we're training real professional artists here.
Absolutely. And I would say that there's another factor to that, which is the American Federation of Violin and Bow Makers, which was founded in the 1980s, and which I think I mentioned before, you know, very strong training to join, and self-policing, in a sense, that we watch over members' work, and we watch over their ethics. And if anybody is not doing good work, or if they get caught with their hand in the cookie jar in any way, then they're expelled. And so the Federation has a strong presence now. And
right. And I know that there are competitions, making competitions.
Right. And the Violin Society of America, which is also a very strong organization, that organization is open to anyone who is interested in the violins, but they do sponsor probably the most prestigious violin making competition in the world. And that has raised the standards of workmanship to a very, very high degree. And there are other competitions in Europe and so forth, but the Violin Society of America competition really is one of the most, if not the most important.
That's very exciting. And we don't want to forget, in addition to the instruments, the violins, the violas, and the celli, and the basses, there are bows that go with each one of them, which I believe is its own specialty, would you say?
Absolutely. That is a separate profession, bow making. And they do call themselves, in the French way, they call themselves archetier, a bow maker. And that is a separate profession of its own. And again, very, very high standards, both in the United States and around the world. So that's an exciting part of the business now.
People don't always understand that a bow is in many ways just as important a partner to an instrument as, you know, anything else, because, as it was explained to me, a player has two hands.
Yeah. Well, I think, in fact, the bow is almost more important, because a good violin being played by a good player, but with a bad bow, the player can't really use the quality of the violin. Whereas with a lesser violin and a better bow, they can get everything out of the violin that is there. So yes, the bow is extremely important.
Mm-hmm. So the myth that the only good string instruments are old ones, you've just debunked that completely for us. And yes, I would say that a younger person, a student who wants to get a good instrument that will help them achieve what they want to achieve as a player, does not have to be a 200-year-old instrument. They can go to Slobodkin Violins in Bangor and find a great instrument.
They can. I like to think so. And many people have. I mean, there are people playing my instruments who are first-rate professional musicians who are playing all over the world. And I think that the older instruments are, many people don't realize that old instruments will always be more expensive because they have a rarity. You know, you can go to there's many good violin makers, and you can go order a violin or buy one right off the shelf in their shop. But if you're looking for a 200-year-old instrument in good condition, they're rare, and you're going to pay a premium for the fact that it's old. It's it has an antique value. And of course, some of them are phenomenally valuable. I mean, Stradivari, the record, I believe now, is over $20 million for a Stradivari instrument. And for that matter, some of the old bows are now reaching $250,000 range.
But now we're talking about art and art values as opposed to audible value. So
Absolutely. Although the good Stradivarius and the good, 18th century Italian instruments do have a sound that is very, very fine, and that many people can appreciate a difference between that and anything else. But the average listener probably cannot. And in fact, there's been multiple tests of people playing new instruments and people playing old instruments for an audience, and the audience trying to guess whether they're old or new, and they're routinely wrong. There's basically no correlation with what the audience thinks and what is actually up there. One real myth is that a bad old instrument will become good. No. If it's a bad instrument to start with, it will only get worse as it gets broken and repaired and so forth. And so there's many, many old instruments that are not worth even repairing.
Right. I'm hoping to play a couple of sound clips of someone playing one of your creations here as part of this presentation. Tell me, how can our Creative Maine listeners find you and avail themselves of your services, either to purchase or rent an instrument or get a restoration?
Well, I have a retail shop in Bangor that covers everything from new instruments, old instruments. I have some very fine old bows and so forth. But I also have everything for students, including small size instruments for 6 and 7 year olds. Mm-hmm. I do have a rental program, and I can be reached by phone at 207-945-4567. Or by email at slobodkinviolins@gmail.com. They can go to my website. They can find all kinds of information on the website, which is Slobodkin Violins. They can call me up and make an appointment. I do work by appointment completely. Okay. So if people, sometimes it can be short notice, but they've got to let me know that they want to come in before I will be here.
Sounds good. Well, thank you so much for coming on Creative Maine with me. It's a very interesting topic. We could probably go on for the rest of the hour, but I appreciate your time and your expertise, and I'm very glad to know that you are right here in Bangor. So thank you, Nate.
Well, thanks very much for interviewing me, and I will look forward to listening to this.
Creative Maine is alive with activities, presentations, workshops, concerts, and all manner of cultural endeavors. At this point in the show, we highlight a few of the many calendar items going on around the region. The Bangor Band continues its 166th season of summer concerts on July 22nd at the Community School in Veazey at 6:30 p.m., July 29th at Cascade Park in Bangor, and August 5th will be a special children's concert at Chapin Park, complete with activities and an instrument petting zoo. In the case of rain, all concerts will take place at Peaks Auditorium. For more information, visit bangorband.org. Art Under the Elms in Castine is a day of art and creativity, welcoming 30 artists from across Maine to the Castine Town Common on July 26th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. All proceeds will benefit Trinitarian Congregational Parish of Castine's community care and outreach programs. For more information, visit castineart.com. Friday, July 25th at 7 p.m., noted local jazz musician Mark Neslusen will be performing a delightful evening of jazz with a combo of friends at the Surrey Art Barn, 8 Crossroad in Surrey. For more information, visit surreybarn.com. For a more complete listing of events, visit our website, weru.org, and click the Community Calendar tab. If you would like to add an item to the community calendar, you may follow the prompts on the calendar page and submit your own event for the list. If you have an event that you feel is particularly pertinent to Creative Maine, send a note with the details to info@weru.org and list Creative Maine in the subject line. You are listening to Creative Maine on WERU 89.9 FM and on weru.org. Next, we discuss the exacting art of bassoon making with Penobscot resident Leslie Ross. Welcome, Leslie Ross, to Creative Maine. I'm so glad you could join me here today. Listeners, please forgive my sultry whiskey tenor. I've had a cold, but we're here to listen to Leslie, and she is going to tell us about her career as a bassoonist, bassoon maker, bassoon restorer. Tell us, how did your path wind from being a performer to a maker? That's quite a leap.
Well, thank you. Well, thank you also for having me today. It wasn't that one led to the other. They actually both happened literally at the same time. When I was in eighth grade and we had to choose an instrument, a wind instrument for wind band, I chose the bassoon. I had a week full of classes and I was allowed to take the instrument home. I think it was like on a Wednesday the following week or something. And the first thing I did when I brought the instrument home was literally strip it of all its keys.
Oh my God.
So there was something about, wanting to know how the instrument worked and was put together that started at the same time as wanting to learn how to play it.
I can't imagine your teacher's reaction.
Well, they never knew. They never knew. I was given quite the talking to, needless to say, by my parents, and I had to stay home the next day. I was home ill, but really I was home to put the instrument back together.
Oh, that's hilarious.
And I swore never to do it again, but of course I did it again, but in a very methodical, just completely stripping everything off and putting it into a pile.
That's so funny. Oh. Now you do it every day for work. I think most people have no idea how a musical instrument is constructed. Now, with a violin, you make it from a block of wood, right? What is the process for making a bassoon? And maybe describe a bassoon for our listeners who may not have seen one in the flesh.
So a bassoon is a doubly reed instrument. It's a bass double reed, so it's often considered, the bass to the oboe. It is actually about an 8-foot long tube that's doubled over on itself. So you hold it on the side the way you might a tenor or baritone saxophone. Mm-hmm. And from the double reed, there's one metal tube that's called the bocal that goes from the reed to the rest of the instrument, and the rest of the instrument is made out of wood. It's a conical instrument also, so it starts actually at the reed. We're talking a diameter of about 4 millimeters, and over those 8 feet, it expands to offhand. I think it's 32 millimeters at the end of it. So okay. it's a very narrow cone. It's not a very wide cone. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if you're making a bassoon from scratch, what does one do?
So it's very much the same as you would do with any woodwind instrument. You would start really the same way that you would start any other woodwind instrument, is you cut your pieces of wood to the desired length. They're the right size. And what you do is you put a hole through it, through the whole length of it. And once you make that preliminary hole, especially if it's a conical instrument like a bassoon, you start widening that cone. You start opening it up with various reamers so that you finally get the finished bore, which is the inside of the wooden instrument. And it's at that point when the bore is done that you then turn the rest of the instrument to that bore, so that bore down the middle of the woodwind instrument is always concentric to the outside of the instrument, and so that the wall thicknesses are also controlled.
Wow.
So that's really any woodwind instrument is made in this manner. Where the bassoon is a little bit, has a complication to it, actually a couple complications to it, is because it is doubled back on itself. So it's an 8-foot tube. There's, about 3.5 feet going down, and then on the other side, that board going up. And that piece is, once again, piece of wood. You make you drill your preliminary hole, you open it up with your reamers, and then you shape that piece of wood and as an oval around those two bores. And that's done just, by sawing and sanding and spoke shaves. And okay, the dimensions. So I guess one important thing which I sort of maybe clarified earlier is that the instruments are of historical instruments. So there, I make Baroque and Renaissance and Romantic, early classical and early Romantic instruments, or rather copies of them, that are then played by musicians. So the tuning is different than what we are tuned to in the 21st and, late 20th century.
Oh, my word. So making a bassoon isn't niche enough. Now we're going into the past and recalling the performance practices of the past.
Right. So, and so where the reamers leave that, the reamers are what give you that final measurement of the bore. So I'm not necessarily measuring what I'm taking out of the bore, because I just go as far as I know a reamer is supposed to go. However, in the tuning process, one of the ways one tunes is when the instrument is completely finished, the keys are on, tone holes are done, you start playing the instrument gradually. And the instrument, just like a violin, it gets played in, it opens up. It not only opens up, but the tuning will change a little, the pitch will change a little as the wood starts to settle in and understand where it's and how it's going to vibrate. And just like a violin, of course, when you're talking about a woodwind instrument, every piece of wood is different. So some of those final tunings can be a little different instrument to instrument. And the way one tunes a wind instrument is, yes, that's, occasionally one can go back in with reamers because you just know that this needs to be opened up a little bit more here. But most of the tuning happens at the tone holes. For tone holes, on tone holes, a lot of it has to do with what we would call the relationship between octaves. It's like you try and get those to fit. And there are ways to open up tone holes that will affect one octave more than another.
Okay, I just want to clarify that a tone hole is the hole on the instrument that gets covered when you make a note.
Where you put your fingers or where you have a key.
Right.
Right. So the tone hole is what allows you to have more than one pitch out of a long tube.
What exactly is a Baroque instrument? What period of time does that cover in the musical, universe?
So the Baroque bassoon, probably the first instrument of which there isn't really an original first instrument or first couple, but it's speculated that the Baroque bassoon was born around 1680. And so by 1700, however, there were many makers who were starting to make the bassoon. And you can envision that this is actually a new instrument. So all the makers that were making this instrument, and it's distinct from a double reed instrument that was a Renaissance instrument, even though they coexisted for some time. That Renaissance instrument was called the dulcian or the kirtle. And it was the same principle of two bores that were conical, two long bores, 8 foot long tube, but it was all in one piece of wood instead of the bassoon, which comes apart in pieces and joints.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just that it came apart in joints. It was an important change in the bore, where the Baroque bassoon had that cone, that conical bore, was narrowed. So it became a much narrower bore. And a number of things happened because of that. First, it opened up a tenor register, a very high tenor register on a bassoon, which wasn't there on the dulcian or kirtle. So if you can imagine, so there's someone, maybe two people, maybe three makers throughout Europe come up with this idea of breaking down this dulcian into pieces, making a bassoon, that it was a really new idea, like it was a new instrument. And it was an incredibly rich period of new instruments also. It wasn't just with bassoons. But it's like everybody had their own idea of what this instrument would be. So if we're talking about a Baroque bassoon, it's very hard to talk about a Baroque bassoon in a very general way, because they were all so different from one another.
Sure.
There are some things. The first instruments only had three keys. As a contrast, modern bassoons have 27, I believe.
Oh, wow.
21. The first instruments only had three keys, and then shortly after there was a fourth that was a common key. And that was for about 100 years. And then the fifth key only really started getting added in classical instruments, or really late Baroque bassoons, and we're talking about 1780. So truly 100 years after the Baroque bassoon.
Right, so that was when Mozart was composing for them.
When Mozart was composing. So actually I'm also thinking so many people had at one point played a recorder in elementary school. So it meant that on the bassoon and on whether it was in bassoon or those first oboes, all of your accidentals, all of your sharps and flats were created by what's called cross fingerings.
Okay.
Which means instead of lifting up a finger one finger at a time, you would lift up one finger and then another finger, and then have a gap and put a finger on a lower tone hole so that there was a gap in your tone holes, so to speak. And that would lower one note, but not so low as that note that you have now left open. It's very hard to explain. it'd be so simple just to show a diagram of this.
I surmise that all these changes that occurred in order to solve problems or enhance.
Well, this is it. It was you had a full chromatic scale, but it took the instrument didn't really do it for you. If you want, this is as a bassoonist, when you play modern bassoon after you're getting off of a Baroque bassoon, you realize all you do is blow and wiggle your fingers.
That's really funny. All you do is blow and wiggle your fingers. We wish it was that easy, right?
I know. Well, it isn't. It isn't.
But I know what you mean. It does a lot of the work,
right,
for you. And I play trombone, and it's very similar.
On the outside, the difference between a Baroque bassoon and a modern bassoon is that instead of the cross fingering, what's happened is that the key opens or closes a smaller hole that's in between two tone holes. It's sort of one simple way of explaining it. And of course, it's not always so straightforward.
Sure, but that makes sense. So I guess as a musician, do you feel that it's important for musicians to have a working knowledge of how their instruments are made? Have you ever done any teaching to conservatory students to say, you know, you play great, but this is how your instrument is made, and, you know, it'll enhance your understanding?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure it's essential. I think it's important that makers really know how to play the instrument they're making. I'm not sure it's necessarily, I don't know that in itself is that important to a musician. What I do feel is important is to have an understanding of, God, I'm going to contradict myself. I guess, is to have a relationship with an instrument, understanding that the instrument in a way is its own, live thing. Like it's a conversation you're having with this object, as opposed to just telling an object what to do.
Sure.
I don't know if that
it makes total sense. I think
there's a feedback loop with playing. So I have taught, and this is like an important, this is the C I'm wanting to hit, and it's out there in the world. This is like, what is the instrument telling you to, like, where is that sound opening up in the instrument? Like, where does that note want to be? And then figure out like where it fits with a tuner, as opposed to then trying to like match everything with the tuner, like get a sense of what's going on between the instrument and yourself. Mm-hmm. As I said, it's sort of like, I feel it's sort of like this conversation.
Feedback loop. Yep, absolutely. And it is a living thing in many ways. And you breathe your life into it, and then you have to understand it and baby it and give it sucker if it needs it. And
right.
Oh, yeah, musicians are a little nuts. Yeah, you have to be. So do you ever give tours of your workshop? It's very interesting to see an entire workshop like that.
I certainly have, both either for, and you know, even individuals can reach out to me, and if, you know, I'll find a time that could work where we could have a little tour. There was a time, and you're just reminding me, because I really haven't gotten back to this since COVID, but there was a time where every year I had a couple of both tours and little mini instrument building workshops with a number of the elementary schools on the peninsula. And I realized like, nah, I need to kind of reach out again and do that again.
I don't think we mentioned that you have chosen that hotbed of instrument making, Penobscot, to be your headquarters. And I know that you lived for many years in New York City. So how did you wind up in Penobscot, Maine?
Well, there was, before moving, there was about a decade, my partner and I were staying at a camp on the St. George Peninsula, and that was my connection to Maine. I had never really, well, so it was rent. We used to rent this camp, and we would come up some years just a month, but there was even one year where I think I managed to do 4 months, and we would just sublet our apartment, and it was like, it was an even trade. So it was sort of like just moving my life from New York to Maine. And with that, suitcases of instruments to finish and also some art projects. So it was like a little self-made retreat. You know, that's how I ended up in Maine. And when it got to a point in the city where, you know, it was clear I couldn't continue living there. And so,
I'm sure people find you at this stage of your career.
They do. I mean, there was the advantage of being in the city where I'd have, you know, musicians often coming through the city. And so then they would stop by, you know, put another day on their trip and just stop by for adjustments on their instruments. And of course, that doesn't quite happen here. But
right. You don't have the walk-in traffic.
Right.
So how can interested Creative Maine listeners find you, your shop or examples of your instrument out in the wild, I'm going to play an excerpt that you have on your website. I'm going to insert that after we're done speaking, but I'd like to know if your instruments are represented in ensembles or other places where they can be heard.
Right. So I've been building, historical bassoons since 1985 and under my own name since 1993. So my instruments are played, as I said earlier, by people who really specialize in playing on period instruments. And they are at this point, you know, very much all over the place. So there are a number of solo CDs out, I have players who are various early music ensembles throughout the world. Any bassoonist knows, like, you listen to a piece of music, you know, it's like a full orchestra, and then you're like, oh, there's a bassoon. So it's a little bit like that. You know, those five notes you hear, or some, you know, it's often more than that. But
right. Well, that's excellent. We are so happy to have you in our neighborhood, as it were. And that's an amazing thing that you do, very unusual. And part of the point of this episode is to illustrate how many creative instrument makers we have in our midst that one might never know. Driving down the street, you wouldn't know, well, somebody makes Baroque bassoons over there, and, you know, violins and violas over there. Pianos and organs over there. It's quite amazing. I think one reason why people love it here is because of the atmosphere of interest and acceptance for what we do. Thank you so much for coming on. Do you have a website that you would like to give out?
I do. It's really just simply leslieross.net.
And I know you have some links on there.
And I do, yeah. I have some links on a link page, in fact. But yes, the website has descriptions of the different instruments that I make.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much. This has been so edifying, very interesting. I'm so glad you're here, and have a wonderful rest of your summer, and hopefully we can talk again.
Well, thank you, and really thank you for inviting me as well. Thank you very much.
Welcome to Creative Maine, David and Nick Wallace, organ builders, organ restorers in Gorham, Maine. It's so great to have you on the program. Maybe you can teach our listeners something about organs in the current world. We tend to think of organs as being a very old thing, and they are, but I think there's all kinds of new technology and new interesting things coming down the pike. So I'm looking forward to our discussion. So you are, as I say, organ builders and restorers. Can you explain what that entails?
Well, I'll start off and then Nick can do it. The shop originally started, or I started the business a little over 40 years ago as a maintenance business, and the reason for that was I jumped into the early moments of the Friends of the Kochmar organ, which is the big organ in Merrill Auditorium at Portland City Hall in Portland, because the organ was in disastrous condition and it was a newly formed group to look after the restoration, the rejuvenation of that instrument. So I got into that just as a temporary helper. It's still there, though, after 40 years. But nonetheless, it opened doors, and I found myself being called to do organ maintenance. My predecessor at Merrill had, at the Kochmar, had retired. He was 83 years old, and so I sort of followed in his footsteps. So that kept me pretty busy, and then that also led to the restoration work, where people would call and say, well, we have an organ, we really like it, but it's full of dirt and things don't work and the leather in the bellows leaks, and can you help us fix that? The answer was most definitely yes. And we would go take the organ apart, bring it to the shop, renew everything, and then take it back and put it back together. And you would have a basically new organ.
Can you explain for a second to us how, in basic terms, how an organ actually works. And we're not talking electronic organ, we're talking mechanical organ.
Well, basically, Nick, you do it. That's your specialty.
In basic terms, what we have to do as organ builders is get very well-regulated pressurized wind to the tip of the pipe. And in between that, we have to allow the organist a way to control that. So in our type of organ building, we have a series of mechanical linkages between the keyboard and the wind chest, which is what the pipes stand on top of. And inside that wind chest is where those linkages end. It's the opposite end from the keyboard. So when you play a note, you are actually opening a valve right under the key, right under the pipes. And the beauty of the mechanical action organ is the organist can really control with just infinite detail how the valve opens and how the valve closes. So more of the organist's interpretation of the piece or their personality can be transferred to the pipes more effectively. So in really basic terms, that's what we do. There are other complications where there's a wall in the way, or there's a floor that we have to go through, or there's a window that we have to keep clear. So all those things, then it gets much more complex.
Well, interesting. I didn't realize that you don't just push the key and it plays, and you lift your finger and that's the end.
Yeah. A lot of the time, where the keyboard is somewhere between 2 and 30 feet away from where the pipes are. In the organ that we're working on right now, we have mechanical linkages that are, I think, up to about 14 feet long horizontally and another 12 feet tall vertically. So when you play a key, you are actually moving many, many feet worth of mechanical linkages, trackers in this case.
Mm-hmm.
So every key comes with, a lot of detailed work to make sure that every single piece is in the right location, the right angle.
You're trying to keep there from being a lag.
Yes. And that's actually one thing that mechanical key action is really good about, is not having any lag. Mm-hmm. Where when you get into electronics and you get into really great distance, hundreds and hundreds of feet between the console and the pipes, that's where you can get into some really challenging delays between what the organist is playing and then what they're hearing. A mechanical action organ, you typically have to be relatively close, somewhere in the 40 foot away, range. And that makes it, because you are actively, moving these linkages, it makes it very quick and very direct.
When you restore an instrument, I would imagine, tell me if I'm wrong, you are taking all those various trackers and linkages and things and making sure that they're functioning as they should.
Absolutely. So when we do a restoration, we have one in the shop right now for St. Joseph's Capitol Hill down in Washington, D.C. And it has three keyboards and a pedal board, which means every single one of those keys has a set of linkages. Every single pedal has a set of linkages. And, we go through it one set at a time and make sure that, everything is properly bushed. Everything is, there's no excess friction and everything is, at the right angle. It's not cracked, all that sort of stuff. So by the end of it, really, we've put in most of the time that it would take to also build these things new. But the end result is a pipe organ that plays as well as, if not occasionally better than, when it was originally installed.
So I would think that restoration is really important, because each instrument has a character of its own that can't be necessarily duplicated by a new. You were saying that the cost is similar to building a new organ, but you can't recapture that quality, that character. Am I right?
To a degree. Organs have a lot of flexibility, you know, separating it from kind of more self-contained instruments, guitars, violins, pianos, where they are really one solid unit. And if any one thing breaks down, it's really kind of the whole thing is breaking down. Organs are just many orders of magnitude bigger in most situations where, you know, you don't find pianos or guitars or cellos or anything that you can walk into, that you can unscrew parts of it. And so organs are a little bit different, but there is a certain character to the voicing of the pipework and the feel of the action. But just based on their size, there's a lot that we can do, getting right down to some nitty gritty measurements of recreating what was there if it got messed up at some point. Mm-hmm. So there's, I think, relative to other instruments, there's a little bit more leeway. And when we do a restoration, it always takes a different avenue. There's not a one size fits all approach for the restoration of any organ. One of the examples is the project we're working on now. For the most part, it is a straightforward restoration, although we are adding a set of pipes to the pedal.
Hmm.
But we have done that by visiting several similar organs, measuring, you know, sets of pipes that were made, you know, in the 1890s,
mm-hmm.
and then formulating our own scale for these pipes based on historic measurements. So there's a lot of kind of backstory to adding something. It's not just pulling something off the shelf and slapping it in there. There is hundreds of hours of documentation and design and research into what would have, you know, how this would have been fit in if the original builder had been asked to do so.
Right. Sort of performance practices of the time too would dictate how you adjust it, I would imagine.
Exactly. Yes. That comes in in the voicing, you know, the sound, how these pipes sound and how they work relative to the other sounds in the organ makes a big difference. Part of the real art of what we do is, in this situation, blending those pipes in so that they work like they've always been there. And when we build a new organ, it's the same sort of thing. We're taking a lot of time to pay attention to what the client's needs are and how they're going to use the organ. And then when we finish building the organ and get it installed, start to voice the organ, make the tiny adjustments to the pipes based on what the needs are and what the room is telling us, because we're always working in different rooms, which is a first important stop of the organ is the room, and then there's all the pipes that you put in the organ.
Right. I mean, in my time, I worked at a historic site in New York with a charming little Handelian organ, and it was restored at that time in the 1980s, I guess it was. But that's a very different kind of use and place than the Wanamaker organ.
well,
that's certainly why I say it's always different, because one of the things in a restoration setting that we always run into is, the fact that these are historical artifacts, but they are also in use. The in-use part really sometimes dictates how historic we can be, because it's, the modern organist is not going to have use for some things, is not going to be willing to use some things. And we have to make some, decisions on what to keep, what to, enhance, what to change. And really, part of the way that we go about that is to make minimal changes. And when we do so in a way that, it can be reversed, or we retain the original pipes and add a new set, so that we never lose full historical context, but we make it so that it's current.
Is there a long history of organ making and thus restoration in New England?
Well, New England... Now, this is coming from a very biased opinion.
Okay.
Boston was the was the birthplace of organ building in America. Well, the folks from Virginia will tell you something to the contrary, that David Tannenberg in Virginia came before the Goodrich firm in Boston. Boston was a major hub of North American organ building for most all of the 19th century, and then partly into the 20th century as well. Organs by the Hook brothers, Elias and George Hook, and then later the Hook and Hastings Company, George Stevens, and all of these companies had offshoots. People would work for them. George Hutchings was the shop foreman for the Hook and Hastings Company until this is where office politics gets into even organ building. Francis Hastings was elevated to a partner with the Hook brothers, and George Hutchings got his nose out of joint and went off and started his own company and was extraordinarily successful. He was an amazing builder and definitely ran competition for his former employer. So Boston was a major hub. New York with Henry Urban and George Jardine and so forth was another hub of organ building. Philadelphia and Virginia. A little later on, St. Louis had several builders. And
Chicago,
then,
I'm sure, did too, yeah.
Chicago, and then San Francisco and Los Angeles had several major companies. Hagerstown, Maryland, for years and years and years, had probably one of the most prolific organ building companies in the United States. I think they built over 32,000 organs in their time.
Wow. Well, if somebody in our listening audience wants to contact Wallace Organs here in Maine, how can they best do that?
The best way, if you're looking to actually contact us, is to go to our website and email us, essentially.
And that
the other
URL
ways
is...
to see what wallacepipeorgans.com.
Mm-hmm.
The other ways that you can kind of keep track on, what's going through the shop is to follow us on either Facebook or Instagram. We try and post regularly with interesting things that are going on in the shop and announcements about organs of ours that are going to be played or anything like that. We try and make sure that we submit articles regularly to the Diapason magazine, to the American Organist.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much, Nick and David Wallace. Nick and David. Father, son, I don't think I mentioned that earlier in the program, but I'm so grateful that you came on. I think this is a fascinating subject, and our Creative Maine listeners will want to find you and find where your organs are being played, I'm sure.
All over the world.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much to our fascinating guests, Nate Slobodkin, Leslie Ross, and David and Nick Wallace. Our theme music is composed and performed by Ariel Chapman. We heard Bach on Slobodkin Cello No. 93, played by Noreen Silver, Vivaldi performed on a Ross bassoon by Josip Boras, and Wallace and Company Portable Organ Opus 73 in St. John's Church in Bangor, played by Kevin Birch. If you have questions or comments for me or any of our guests, please send them to info@weru.org. Please write Creative Maine in the subject line. Please join Creative Maine at WERU 89.9 FM or on weru.org for another eclectic episode on Thursday, August 21st at 4 p.m. Eastern Daylight Savings Time, when we will learn about some hidden gems of performance venues in Maine. Thank you so much for listening. This is Adina Salmonson, wishing you a wonderful month of the arts and crafts that enrich your life and bring you joy.